Welcome to the 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at the Incredible Hulk series.
How long has it been since you felt real pain?
Part of Percolated Media's full Marvel podcast series.
It's a wonderful plan, isn't it?
Join Matt.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Adam.
You look like a massive nerd, even around other scientists.
And Garrett.
The third was some giant, if I can believe the descriptions.
As they look at various film iterations of the Incredible Hulk character.
I hate them.
Wait, I just got here. Who do we hate?
From Bill Bixby to Eric Bana.
You could always close out the world when you wanted to.
The three co-hosts will review 4 Hulk TV movies, as well as the 2003 Ang Lee-directed film.
No one can take that kind of punishment.
So prepare to Hulk yourselves out, podcast listeners. The Percolated Media Incredible Hulk Retrospective begins now.
In each of us, there lives a kind of beast made of rage. Years ago, I used science to study this beast, to bring him out of me. I used gamma radiation to release him, but I used too much.
Hulk, released June 20th, 2003, budget about $137 million, box office $245 million, not quite Hulk smash there, and this was directed by Ang Lee. Well, it was directed by Ang Lee, but he certainly wasn't the original choice because, as we alluded to at the conclusion of last week's show, they wanted to make a Hulk movie on the big screen as early as 1990. It only took 13 years.
13 years, and not until 2018 would I be so upset at such a meaningless death when Luke died at Last Jedi and had to start that fight again. So I was really excited when I heard, okay, we got a new Hulk movie coming out. Gillian Hurd was attached to this thing relatively quick, and I'm thinking, oh God, am I excited? We're going to get this by the mid-90s. No, it took till 2003. Wow.
It did. And Adam, let's talk about the funny business that was happening at Marvel. The late 80s, early 90s was when Marvel basically went bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, not basically. They went bankrupt.
They went bankrupt, yep.
And in all those legalities and proceedings, that's how... All right, time to mention this name again. Mr. Avi Arad got himself involved in producing Marvel Entertainment because he was the... I think he was the CEO of Toy Biz or the executive president, something like that. One of the higher-ups. And he eventually became the founder... and former CEO, you know, now he's no longer that, of Marvel Studios when it became an actual LLC company. So that's part of why it took this a while to get made, because of Marvel is not in a good place. And the movies we've talked about, the Dolph Lundgren Punisher, talked about, or I should say we alluded to the 1990 Captain America being pulled from theaters. Those were right about when this was starting to get made. So I don't think it was the biggest surprise in the world that it took a little bit for that to kind of get off the ground once again in 1992. And if you don't know your Marvel history and you're wondering why around the time this movie came out, why so many different companies had the rights to various characters, Marvel had these things called Marvel cards that were basically the chief instrument in the destruction of the company. And a large portion led to the bankruptcy. And once Marvel realized, oh my God, we're in the red and it's not looking good, they sold the movie rights to their characters to any studio that wanted them. You know, this is how Marvel, or I should say this is how Sony got involved with certain properties. This is how New World Pictures, Fox, you know, everybody got a piece of the Marvel pie. And Universal was the company that bought the rights to the Hulk. And not long after that, The Stan the Man himself was invited into Universal's offices in 1993 with a screenwriter in tow, Michael France, who we've talked about. This is the guy who wrote GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, revitalized Bond along with Martin Campbell and various others, but he was an interesting choice to get, and they pitched a movie, and their concept, being Universal, because they had an idea for what they wanted to do, which Frank disliked, was having the Hulk fighting terrorists, because we were in the aftermath of the Gulf War and Operation Desert Storm and all that. So while it was topical, I'm not sure that would have been befitting of the Hulk's big screen debut. France did not like that idea. So they kind of pushed him out the door and they brought in John Turman to write a script. And Stan Lee liked this script. And as much as I like Stan Lee and what he contributed to Marvel and how he made himself a brand as much as the characters he created, I don't think he was always the best when it came to balancing out other people's ideas. I think oftentimes he was more of an enabler to let people kind of go beyond what was believed or to be, because this script, of which there were 10 drafts, so right away this should tell you how messy this got. Hulk was going to fight a bunch of stuff. The leader was going to be in it, the military, Rick Jones was going to be in the movie, not Rick James, everybody, relax. And they were going to say that there was like an atomic explosion, which is from the comics, and this is an important detail that's basically been kept until the finished product, bringing in Bruce's father as the reason why he's such this tortured soul. Because that was an invention of the comics around, I want to say it was like the early to mid 80s. That wasn't a mainstay of the character when he was initially created, but they eventually said, what if Bruce Banner had an abusive father that basically played a role in him becoming the Hulk?
Okay, I thought James Samus brought that. So you're saying that goes back to the mid 90s.
As far as I know in doing the research, that was an invention of John Turman's script.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And Universal were kind of mixed on the script, which is why they went through 10 drafts and all these revisions. It was basically like the equivalent of getting a movie that's rated R approved by the MPAA to get cut down, where you have to keep resubmitting it to get their approval. So the script was still in the works. Now we can talk about some of the directors. I forgot to mention this on The Punisher 2004, that Jonathan Hensley, while that was his feature film debut, he was brought in first as co-producer to work on the Hulk film because, and I didn't mention this, and I should have, he was married to Gail Ann Hurd.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to know why this creative stiff based on The Punisher got his first shot, it's because his wife was producing the movie. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that certainly helped get him in the chair. And Universal also hired ILM to be the ones to create the Hulk fully in CG, because we've, in the history of film, we're a couple years removed from Terminator 2 and about a year removed from Jurassic Park, which really changed the landscape along with The Abyss. You know, you can't, or young Sherlock Holmes, depending on how far back you want to go. CGI was becoming the new pioneering force in visual effects, and ILM was very much at the forefront of that.
Yeah, and as I mentioned at the end of last week's show, that was the draw, a big draw for me when I was hearing about this thing being brought to the screen, is now we're going to have the assistance of computer effects. Now we're going to have T2 style, T1000 CGI effects to enhance what already was a big guy in Lou Ferrigno. Now we're going to have an even bigger dude. And that's what made it exciting for me, and seeing all that personified in full Hulk smash capabilities.
Adam, would a non-CGI Hulk have excited you in like 1995? Like, let's say they got, I don't know, insert pro wrestler here to play the Hulk. Would that have sold at all?
Don't think you could have been 95. You know what? It's funny, at that point, I was into, you know, watching Olympia again and some of that. The issue is, I mean, I guess if you could find a way to make Ronnie Coleman green, you did have some giant people, but Hulk and comics started to seem otherworldly. So I do think the leaps in CG technology made it something you wanted. You know, you kind of wanted that comic book feel on screen. I don't know of anybody live action you could have done anymore. I think that time had passed.
And going back to Hensley's script, in doing my research, I found that, goddamn, what a stupid idea. He's fighting like insect men the entire time.
Yeah.
So, like, and there's some concept art out there that they did. It's unbelievable. I'm so glad they didn't go with that.
Yeah,
because yeah, that's Hensley, the dumb idea. Hold on to it.
Well, Hensley started out as just the co-producer with his wife, but Joe Johnston was the first person they talked to directing, because he had just done The Rocketeer and Jumanji, both of which, I mean, look, one of the stars of The Rocketeer is in this movie, so maybe she was talked up even as far as back then. This would have been around like April 97, and Hensley wrote Jumanji, so you're kind of reteaming some people. And when that started to come into play, they fired France before he wrote a single page. They did buy him out. But Johnston dropped out not too long after because he wanted to make October Sky instead. Because when you're asking me, would I rather make a Hulk movie or work with Jake Gyllenhaal, I will always take the latter.
October Sky is a very good film, too. That's probably Johnston's most heartwarming film, actually, is that particular film.
Yeah, and you watch that movie and you see why Gyllenhaal became who he became.
I was talking about Johnston, not Gyllenhaal, but go ahead.
So what happened was when Johnston left, Hensley used his power of nepotism smash to convince Universal to let him direct the movie, even though he had never directed a movie. I don't even think he had done like Second Unit or anything. So I right away, when you read this, you're like, oh boy, I don't know if Universal is just saying, get this out no matter what. They brought Terman back to write two more drafts. So now we're up to 12 with this poor bastard. And then they brought in Zach Penn to rewrite it. Now, ironically, this is the same guy who will do co-writes on the 2008 Hulk film. Mm-hmm. He co-wrote X2 and X3. So this was kind of his introduction. And that script, when it says this script, I'm sure it's one of the 12 drafts. Hulk was going to fight a school of sharks. Because we have to remember also, comic book movies were not yet taken seriously because we were not too far. In fact, we were months removed from Batman and Robin, almost nuking the entire genre.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the things they kept actually wound up in the 2008 film. Him not being able to have sex without hulking out and the falling out of a helicopter triggering him. Those were both in the script. Hensley then rewrote everything himself. And this is where, oh my, so we talked about the Insect Man, so let's talk about how this came to be. So before he became the Hulk, he was experimenting on gamma-induced insects and mixing their DNA with convicts. So if you've ever seen the movie Mansquito on the Sci-Fi channel, it's basically that, and it probably would have looked as good.
With Corky Nemec as Mansquito. Yeah, I tell you, you're right. Comic book films still weren't... This was pre-Blade around this time. It was still the mid-90s, right?
Yep. Blade was 98.
Yeah, so yeah.
Because this was going to be... Yeah,
this
they,
year
they wanted it to release in 1999. So it would have been hypothetically between Blade and X-Men.
Okay. Yeah, they were still trying to feel their way out of this. And don't forget, too, this was around the time the Tim Burton Superman film was being in production, too. And you had John Peters trying to stick his nose in that, trying to say, yeah, you need to fight a giant spider or whatever the hell that was. They didn't know what the hell to do with these characters at this time. It really does show, and I know you guys throw them under the bus all the time, and when we get to the movies, I'm sure I will too, but this is why you needed someone like Kevin Feige to come around and just kind of straighten this train on its fucking tracks. Because look at how many different fucking bad ideas we have floating around here because we don't know what the fuck to do with this character.
Well, this is why I think you should get a director first and then build from there.
Yeah.
Because more often than not, the director is the, especially back then, he was the, directors had a lot more power over these big movies because they really, the studios weren't motivated as much by nickel and dimes, and these movies hadn't yet become like ghost directed by the visual effects departments because they still had to work in unison because the technology wasn't fully up to par yet. But as I said, they wanted this to be around like summer of 1999 was their plan, which in hindsight probably was a good move because Phantom Menace would have been around that time. And it would have gotten, Hulk would have been taken out by Jar Jar Binks. They pushed filming back. Then the script got rewrote, one of the writers being J.J. Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
So as far back as, you know, the late 90s, he had his hands in these type of movies. They also brought on a pair of writers that mostly did biopics. They wrote the Ed Wood, they wrote the People versus Larry Flint. Interesting choices to do a Hulk movie.
Yeah, Man on the Moon. Yeah, and we're going to talk about J.J. Abrams again when it comes to another big production. We're going to be talking about him twice this month about concepts that didn't come to fruition. But yeah, he was still around this time. You're right. He had his hands in a lot of pies around this time.
And then they, once everybody was hired, so Abrams and the writing duo, Hensley was going to direct. They went into pre-production. They were doing makeup tests. They were doing some computer animation. They had cast the main villain, who was basically going to be like an original character. And then one of them was a guy who was like part human, part ant, part beetle. Probably would have been a disaster. But they put the movie on hiatus because at the time, it was already budgeted at $100 million, which was a lot of money at the time. And that's a lot of money to trust with a guy who had never made a feature film before, let alone a movie of this, pardon the pun, of this scale.
Yeah, it was something like a year, 10 months or something in pre-production. They were spending a lot of money, but they still hadn't gotten everything right when it came to this. I mean, they were really stuck at this point.
I mean, man, and then Michael Frantz comes back again. He pitches a third time. They hire him again. They fast-tracked that script. They were going to start filming at the turn of the millennium. And what he said made this vision that he came up with different, because by this time they sort of panned the previous scripts. He said that he wanted to do stuff about like regenerative capability, anger management, the gamosphere, a lot of that stuff happened. And then that script was rewritten by two more guys, which, and this script had Hulk, Leader, Absorbing Man, Zax, all of them being like the same colleagues. It's basically like the Fantastic Four, where they all get their powers from one accident. And around that time was when Ang Lee became involved in this project.
Well, they were going to take it into a comedy direction, too. They always play that card, right? You know, we can't figure out how to play this straight lace, so we're going to go comedy. And they were going for someone like Jim Carrey or Adam Sandler in the role of the Hulk, which really... Which
right away, at that point, you might as well just can the project entirely. No one's taking it as legitimate, which is so fascinating when you get a director who had just made Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon to come in and basically salvage the movie, because Ang Lee had done... Sense and Sensibility was his very first movie. Or I should say his first breakthrough in America. They did The Ice Storm, which also got very good praise. They did a Western movie called Ride with the Devil, which it's kind of unseen. Like a lot of people, it's pretty good. And what's funny about Ride with the Devil and The Ice Storm, Ang Lee is like one of the only directors who knows how to tell Tobey Maguire to act.
You know what I love about Ang Lee? He never makes the same movie twice.
No. And his movies are very different.
Very different. And that was kind of the draw around this time, because I haven't seen too much of his work. I know Crouching Tiger is what got him this gig. That had been nominated for a lot of Academy Awards. It kind of came out of nowhere. And I remember seeing it in theaters because of the buildup for it and just being pissed off that it was just people dancing around on trees for 2 hours. But I eventually warmed up to it and what it was trying to say. But yeah, he turned down Terminator 3 to do this. And that was one of the big draws. I'm like, wow, we got this little independent filmmaker coming in to do this huge production and put it back on its feet. I was excited. I was stoked.
For somebody that hasn't done different works, but you knew about Crouching Tiger, he seemed to be that influx of Asian directors bringing a new feel to what was, you know, kind of a stale market. And his name alone, as new as he was to Western shores, was an exciting piece.
Well, it's the most, at the time, it was far and away the most audacious choice they had ever gotten for a superhero film. Especially with Marvel, when you look at Stephen Norrington directed Blade, who had only done like one or two movies before that.
Yeah, they were kind of plucking directors like this left and right. And you mentioned last week that this was kind of the end of that era. It was always exciting when you see someone like this get a hold of a production like this.
Well, and as I mentioned, you know, you had Stephen Norrington, you had Bryan Singer do X-Men, who had only done a couple movies, but he had directed an Oscar-winning film. The turning point's really Sam Raimi. And Ang Lee were basically hired around the same time. You know, because Sam Raimi started out as basically Stephen Norrington, you know, making movies like that. I mean, this is the guy who got to start with Evil Dead. And then he had shown I can do other stuff with things like A Simple Plan, Quick and the Dead.
The Gift.
The Gift, you know, big studio films. But he was also a massive Spider-Man fan. So getting Ang Lee was even a step above that, where you got someone who had truly had a voice, much like Sam Raimi. And he had his choice. You know, Terminator 3 was a very anticipated movie for a lot of reasons. And he chose this instead. But in doing so, he basically commissioned another rewrite. He said, let's mix The Absorbing Man with David Banner. And his influences, and this goes to show the perspective Ang Lee looked at this versus everyone else. He wanted things like King Kong, Greek mythology, Faust, Jekyll and Hyde. Some of those more obvious than others, but he clearly had influences that he wanted to use for, in his mind, what he wanted this Hulk story to be.
He wasn't a fan, right?
He wasn't a comic book guy, but he never, it wasn't like a Tim Burton situation where he talked down about the genre, but to my knowledge, he wasn't like a hater, but he also wasn't like an uber fan. He just, they said, this is the character, what can you do with it? He wanted the Hulk to be completely naked.
Yes.
But there was no way with a PG-13 rating that you could do that. So we had to wait for Watchmen to see that for all intents and purposes. And then the script got rewritten again multiple times. Stop you if you've heard this before. So eventually we come up with a movie where you have three writers getting credit.
Yeah, going back to the naked thing, I remember I watched a lot of behind the scenes for this. And what they said about that is while Ang Lee had a big vision for that, they just kept hiding him behind trees and things to maintain that PG-13 rating. And it just looked more like Austin Powers in a fucking serious comic book film. So
yeah, you're playing hide the sausage.
Yeah. they canned that idea pretty quick.
So that's the production. Eventually the movie was done and they started up the marketing, which really started, ironically, around Spider-Man's release. They put a teaser in front of that. They released that teaser when The Scorpion King hit DVD, which that movie did very well, which shouldn't be a surprise, although mm-hmm. it's not especially great. But then they spent $2 million on the Super Bowl ad. And this got a lot of people excited because... Well,
it got people excited. I was excited, but it also got people talking, and not in a good way, because it got people saying, well, maybe these makeup effects aren't going to be up to speed. I remember the big thing was they put that trailer out without finished effects, and people were pissed. I remember just kind of putting all that in my mind. I'm like, I have full faith that this team is going to put all this together. And me and my friends had long discussions about this. God, was this built up. And I mentioned last week that this was my most anticipated. I think Freddy vs. Jason might have been a little higher than this, but I was still really, really stoked, even given those bad effects in that first trailer.
All right, Adam, well, let me ask you. We had Daredevil, X2, and this all in the span of like 6 months. Was this a distant third for you in your anticipation?
He beat me to it. This was absolutely a distant third on that list. And it's not because of what the movie is, because I didn't know. But as I mentioned before, Hulk, not really my jam. But Daredevil as a character and the people involved in that movie, I was big fans of. And we're going to discuss X-Men eventually. But I will say that first X-Men movie is the film I've seen most in movie theaters. So that second one, yeah, that was the movie for me that year. But this one, that first trailer, I didn't hate it because as a fan of ILM, I had faith in that company. But they did screw the pooch by trying to excite people too early. And it was Shrek. The fucker looked like Shrek.
Yeah, and that was the joke. They should have called this, you know, Get Out of My Swamp or something like that. And it didn't help that Shrek had just come out a couple years before this. But I got to say that I thought the Super Bowl ad, effects be damned, I thought it did a good job of kind of teasing what the Hulk was going to look like. And, you know, they teased something a little bit more sinister. You know, it's clear they were taking this seriously. Not as much as you could for a 10-foot-tall green monster. But unfortunately, a couple weeks before the movie came out, a bunch of work prints leaked on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that saw it were not very complimentary. In fact, this thing kind of, due to that and due to the, I would say, skepticism around how the Hulk was going to fully look, the movie kind of went in with one arm tied behind its back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a friend who actually had a work print of it, and at this point, you couldn't really put it on a big screen TV. If I was going to watch it, it would have to be on my desktop, and I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to fucking put it on my computer. I'm not going to watch it on a computer. I want to wait for the big screen to see it. And from what I heard, I never actually saw it, but it was one of those things where certain effects were inserted. It says, insert effect here. It definitely wasn't finished, and people still bitched at it, like, oh, these effects aren't finished. It's, well, yeah, that's why they call it a work print. So very positive thinking still going to that Thursday night showing.
Now, we do also need to clear up some misconceptions about the movie's box office, because most people see the finished total and say, my God, that's kind of a disappointment. Well, when the movie came out, it made $24 million on its opening day. So people showed up to go see it, and it made $21 million on its second day. So opening weekend in total, when it was all said and done, was about $62 million, which was in the top 20 of highest grossing opening weekends ever. It beat Finding Nemo at the box office, and it was the biggest June opening weekend in history at the time. Now, that lasted only a year because the boy wizard came and told the Hulk to get the fuck out of the way. And it was one of Universal's biggest hits, behind Lost World, Mummy Returns, and Bruce Almighty. That's a weird trio, but you got a sequel to Jurassic Park, a sequel to The Mummy, and a Jim Carrey star vehicle. So those are all going to do well. And then the second weekend, it hit a 70% drop. And it was the first opener that made over $20 million to drop at least 65%. So it was kind of historic in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And its second weekend, it lost to the Charlie's Angels sequel.
Yeah, definitely a victim of bad word of mouth. I remember at this point, I was working and going to school. And what I worked was UPS. UPS shifts, early shifts, start at 3:30. But I was determined to see this thing on that Thursday night. So I went Thursday night at midnight. You didn't have 7 o'clock Thursday showings at this time. You were going that first night, you went at midnight. So I went at midnight with a group of friends. I had about two or three other people who went with me. And I sat right through that, man. It was a buildup. I remember coming out saying, well, that was different. It wasn't what I expected. And I'll get into reasons why as we get into the film, but it's not one of those that comes up after you watch it. You're like, man, that was such great slam bang entertainment. It took me by surprise.
Adam, did you actually see this in the theater?
Yeah, this did end up being a theater watch for me, and it was a discussion with people afterwards. I was still going to see it. Daredevil had already come out. X2 had already come out. So yeah, I was definitely going to hit the trifecta. And yeah, I remember theaters being excitable that opening weekend. I'm pretty sure it was not midnight, but I did see that first weekend, and you had pretty good crowds, especially in the early 2000s. Look, theaters weren't packed like they are now. 100 million openings weren't a thing, but it did well that first weekend, even up against the juggernaut that was from Justin to Kelly. So it did.
Yeah, I remember that.
It did what it did, and I was there, and it spawned conversations.
Me and Adam weren't talking at this time, so we had these separate experiences. But I do remember, Adam, do you remember those fucking Hulk arms that came out when this movie was released?
Yep.
I had a set of those. I brought it to that screening. That's how excited I was for this fucking movie.
Well, for me as a 10-year-old, or soon-to-be 10-year-old, I didn't care for this when it came out. Because I said what a lot of grown men said, there's not enough Hulk smashing. It was a lot more talky than people thought it would be, which... were people expecting like just a 90-minute Hulk demolition derby? Because if that was your anticipation or expectation going in, you were going to be disappointed no matter what when you saw a 2-hour and 20-minute runtime. You got to fill it with something of substance.
They were expecting what we're going to be talking about in a set of years with the Edward Norton film. That's what they were expecting. Nothing like this. And my God, does this tackle issues that if I had known about this, Adam, I know your kids weren't born at this time when this movie was out, but man, I don't know if I would take a son to take a kid to this less than 12 years old, because there's some deep shit going on in this film.
Yeah, someone, I mean, we can start getting into it, but yeah, someone's working out their daddy issues throughout this film.
Well, that's why he said this was Freudian and Greek in a lot of ways when Ang Lee was coming up with it. And you can clearly see those influences. But there were some pretty big defenders. Roger Ebert, who didn't really care for the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man film, he gave this a pretty positive review. And some other critics liked it, but there was plenty of divide. It certainly sparked conversation, more so than something like... Spider-Man was pretty universally loved, no pun intended, because that's a Sony production. And X2 had done remarkably well, critically and commercially. A lot of people at the time were saying, oh, this is far and away the best movie Marvel's ever made. Daredevil, not so much. That kind of got a more negative reception than this. This was certainly very mixed. But it's been reappraised. You know, we've had 20 years since this. We've had two other actors play the Hulk since this, two of which in the same continuity, which makes it fascinating. And it's always fun to go back to this period of superhero films and assess what we have, because what we have is certainly not... The one thing you cannot accuse this movie of being, and there's a lot of adjectives you could throw at it, it's not formulaic.
Oh, no.
Which is also more impressive, because Spider-Man kind of set the formula for superhero films for a long time. Especially the first one for characters, like Daredevil, The Punisher. A lot of them follow the same template, especially in the Marvel line. This did not follow a template. In fact, I think it was intending to start a new trend, but the reception is kind of what kicked that to the curb. One thing that is formulaic, though, to finally get into the movie, we get the Marvel comic page turning logo, but I think this is the first time they used an exclusive character, because these are all Hulk comics we're seeing panel.
Yep, all green, too.
All green, and, you know, because, like, I think Spider-Man had this, Daredevil had this. Adam, did the first X-Men have this? I don't remember.
Don't think the first X-Men movie did.
I know
it's been a minute, and I've been waiting for my rewatch until we get to it, but I don't believe so.
But we open with pretty stylized credits of a scientist doing genetic experiments. And look, this movie, if you are an animal lover, I almost have to say don't watch this movie, because it is a giant, like, a lot of statements are going to be made about the movie and its themes. This is very much an anti-animal experimentation movie.
I haven't heard it put that way, but definitely. And, you know, this gets this off right on that foot. Of the themes that it's going to be tackling. And one thing that's worth noting too is Ang Lee's wife is a biologist, and all of this stuff was put in by her. She kind of worked on this as well, and this is authentic biology we're seeing on screen. I like the way this starts. Now, one thing worth noting, we talked about the opening Marvel Flip logo. That logo is all green. All of this is all green. Guys, I want to talk about Ang Lee's style right off the bat. I don't think there is a frame of this film that doesn't have a hint of green in it. And I do like the way Ang Lee is showing right away that Hulk is lingering and he's going to come. You just have to be patient. I like the way we're seeing Hulk hover in a nondescript way.
Adam, you want to chime in before I respond? Or
yeah, these opening credits are like a montage fever dream. I feel like I'm in some weird ass art house film that I didn't expect. This is a weird way to open your superhero, your big budget superhero movie.
Well, it's a weird big budget superhero movie. And Matt, before you chime in, I want to talk to Adam for a second because you're not going to have an opinion on this. We have themes being done by Danny Elfman here. Now, they had hired Ang Lee's composer who had worked on the Ice Storm, and I think the studio, Gillian Hurd, they were just like, you know what, this isn't working. Let's bring somebody who has established superhero themes. And Danny Elfman, you know, I found when they hit the 2000s and he was kind of separated from Burton around this time, there was nothing that he was doing that was really memorable, except for Spider-Man. I do think Spider-Man's a pretty damn good superhero score. I do like what he is doing with the Hulk in this. I love the opening theme to this. I love how it is foreboding. It's also very catchy. You know, this is the theme that actually ends this podcast. I'm not going to say it's fun. Nothing about this movie is fun. But I do like Danny Elfman's score in this.
Yeah, I think it's one of his worst. I think really? It's forgettable. And I don't think it fits. And I think it's clear that he had like 3 weeks to do a score.
Well, Ang Lee was hovering over his shoulder saying, I want this less Danny Elfman like. I was watching behind the scenes.
And don't hire Danny Elfman because all he can do.
And I think that goes with some of Ang Lee's bad impulses when it comes to this film, this genre, in that he keeps telling him, and Danny Elfman says it, and he goes, I like that he told me that because it made me go different, but I'm probably alone on this hill. I like the result.
As somebody who just went to a theme park that literally is scored by Danny Elfman, I was astounded when I looked back up in the credits and went, I can't believe this is Danny Elfman. He's done an amazing amount of his body of work. Going back to Oingo Boingo can't really be denied, but just not for me.
Like a lot of the style in this movie, oftentimes it's trying to put a square peg into a round hole. Not just the opening theme, but I want to talk about one of the hallmarks of this movie that's been contestedly debated is how Ang Lee tries to incorporate the comic book medium into cinematic form. And it starts in this opening montage with the way he edits sequences and the way he'll juxtapose different images, the transitions, like you're reading a comic book panel, the font on the cast list is right out of a comic. While I appreciate that he is trying to take the style from one medium into another, I don't think it always works. And I think it's ambitious to a fault.
Matt, I am right with you. This whole thing of separating these scenes and panels is the right impulse for the wrong movie. Eric Bana is very vocal on those vignettes about the fact that he had to do these scenes over and over and over. If you're doing take after take for one or two angles, imagine doing it for all of these angles when you're putting these panels together. And when you have this being followed by the shit that we're going to see with this father behind this closed door and what's going on besides the abuse going on, that is not the place to put panels like this. These panels do not belong in this movie. He does a lot in the beginning and he does a lot at the end. The middle, he calms down on it, but yeah, it's not right for it.
Yeah, I remember when it first happened, I was like, oh, that's cool. Somebody's mimicking, you know, the comic style. It's good in theory, but you got to utilize it right. And it's not utilized right in here, except for very, very rare occasions. I admire the impetus, not the execution.
Yeah, I think this would have been, like, I'm surprised Sam Raimi didn't try this with Spider-Man, given his directing style. I think it actually would have fit that project better than this one, certainly. And a tribute to the TV show, the Bill Bixby show, we see this as David Banner, not Bruce Banner, so his father, doing experiments on what he believes to be human regeneration. That's what he's working towards. You see his notes. He's cutting up starfish, which, as a SpongeBob fan, is like a dagger in my heart. And he's told by his superior, who will come out and find out this is someone else, a notable Hulk character. He's told he can't do any human experiments, even though he's done every animal under the sun. He's doing rats, he's got monkeys, he's got starfish. This movie runs the animal kingdom. We got frogs, we got bugs later on. Like, every kind of animal gets experimented on in some capacity here. But because, now this is very Spider-Man, no human trials, so he experiments on himself. And by so doing, he seemingly passes on his research to his biological son, Bruce. And right away we see that he's not a normal kid, because we see that we're told he's hit by a baseball bat by another kid. And he doesn't cry, he doesn't yell at the kid or punch him in the face, he just takes it and keeps going. So I found this to be I'm fascinated buy this take on Bruce Banner and the Hulk being something that he's born with and was something like, almost like a family curse, not something that he entirely gets out of his own self-doing. I don't know if it 100% works, but I admire this approach because it certainly distinguishes it from almost every other version I can think of.
All right, a couple things about this. One, a month of doing these Hulk shows and talking all about David Banner. And now we have David Banner in this, but it's actually Bruce Banner's father. I was confused. I had completely forgotten about that. And we'll talk about Nick Nolte here in a bit. But as far as this whole dynamic, I was going to ask you guys, has there ever been a run of the comics where the father actually puts it in Bruce before he gets hit with the gamma radiation?
Well, the problem with myself is I'm not well-versed in the Hulk's history outside of a couple runs, so I don't know if I can 100% answer that.
Yeah, if so, I'm not aware of it. I would not be surprised that some run has it after this fact, but I don't know of any that was done before.
I think I like what they're going for with this, because David Banner does not see Bruce as his creation. He is creating what he's going to be proud of. At the very end of this movie, I'm going to go ahead and jump to the very end here. At the end, he goes, I don't want to see you. I want to see my son. Meaning he wants to see the Hulk, which is what he created. So those themes are very prevalent. And the more I thought about it that way, the more I liked it. And of course, we have nuclear testing going on at this point. I think it's a little too late for that, but we're seeing mushroom clouds all over the place in this fucking movie. I like the dynamic that Ang Lee is building with that.
I think this is what turned off a lot of people, is that while superheroes are tragic by nature, this is one of the most dour superhero films that had been made at the time. And I think my biggest criticism of it, and I'll have good things to say about it, certainly, I think the movie is too dour for its own good. There's not a moment of genuine happiness from a character, from any of the main characters in this entire movie. And it makes it heavy to a fault.
Yeah, because even in those TV movies, there were moments to chuckle at, even as morose as Bill Bixby was in those films. Yeah, I'm right with you. And you might have the right cast for that, because I don't know if any of these people have ever laughed in their lives, but it is not a fun film to sit.
So David's research gets shut down and he runs back home after basically scorching his lab for all intents and purposes. He sets the gamma reactor to explode, and we see him... when he gets home, the mom takes Bruce under the table like you had to do in school if there was a nuclear bomb, because mm-hmm. We thought school desks could withstand a nuclear blast. Boy, how far we've come. Line of logic. And David grabs her and takes her into the room, and we are led to believe that Bruce doesn't see what happened. So we're kind of getting with Ang Lee's directing, we're getting some repressed memories, and we're getting the Rashomon thing of like perspective and what actually happened. So we're setting up a mystery, although it's pretty blatantly obvious if you can read between the lines what actually transpired.
This is where is if I had brought a kid, a son, to this movie, I would have probably taken him out, because the shit that goes on behind this door is so fucking foreboding and is so wrenching to watch. And I'm like, I'm coming here for a comic book film, and all of these fucking repressed memories and things are coming. This is quite a ballsy thing to do in your big budget Hulk film that you've been building for 13 years.
I think this is where, I mean, it's amazing. We're only a few minutes into this movie, and it's, is there anybody likable? You know, is there any sense of joy? Preview. No, there really isn't.
Well, I like one. You know, only because of the way she looks.
But to have potential abuse, and it feels like this maybe isn't the first time. And I got no doubt what happens to the mom. And it's just, again, this is how you're opening your film. You got that weird montage to, oh, and then you're doing this. Man, it's a choice. I just can't believe that the exec screened this and went, yep, cut, print, send it to theaters.
And market Hulk hands to 7-year-old kids.
Yes! And listen, this movie's like 2 hours, 15 minutes. So it's not like this could not have been completely excised from this film, because it's all explained again later multiple times. I just think it sets you off on a bad tone.
See, I wouldn't say bad. I would say misguided. The scales are tipped too far into trying to be contemplative and... Like I said, I think dour is just the word I keep going back to.
Yeah, joyless. Well, let's not forget, too, this isn't necessarily new, because 3 years before, Bryan Singer opened X-Men at a Nazi concentration camp. So it's...
Yeah, he did, but the one excuse, I don't want to say excuse, but that was actually comic accurate.
Okay.
you know, because Magneto being a Holocaust survivor, that is the core of that character, to explain his perspective. Now, although nowadays, like, if they do the X-Men soon, we're going to have to come up with something else, because Magneto would be, like, 90 mm-hmm. if you said it in present day, which I guess makes sense, because they're still making Ian McKellen play the fucking character. With this, like I said, I don't know if this is pulled from a particular run, but if this is, like, an invention of this movie, I applaud the boldness. I don't think you can do anything but admire it, but it makes it difficult to, because a lot of this movie is very uncomfortable in a way that's not typical of this genre. I can't think of another superhero movie where so much of it, I'm thinking about what it's trying to tell me, but it's not making me evoke the medium it's inspired by. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm looking at this fully through the lens of, like, a family drama, borderline a thriller. But then you're juxtaposing it with all the comic book imagery and the paneling. So yeah. There is a disconnect. Much like Bruce's memory, because he suppresses all this. We cut to him as I thought he was going to Michigan with his shirt on, because he's got, like, the Michigan Wolverine football shirt on as he's going to college with, I guess, Aunt May adopted multiple kids. Because this is very Peter Parker-esque, where she tells him, like, you're going to be a scientist, you're going to do good things. I guess this is the warmest scene in the movie by default, and it's 10 minutes in. And we never mention the step-parent again.
Yeah, never.
And this kid goes away, and we're introduced to Eric Bana as Bruce Banner. Right, saying that five times fast. Yeah. Who was basically... He wasn't the only person considered. Let's talk about casting, because I found this interesting. So Ang Lee saw the movie Chopper, which, if you've seen that movie, as great as he is, I don't see Bruce Banner in that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't a huge name. Mm-mm. So I appreciate that he got, like, an actor to play the role, although this is a guy who got to start doing, like, comedy television. And the other choices, so look, Billy Crudup reportedly turned down the role. I think he would have been very good.
I agree.
I think he would have been great.
But they were looking at some bigger names. Johnny Depp was considered, I guess, because he saw Danny Elfman and thought Tim Burton was going to direct this. But it would have been weird, because remember, this came out a month before Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if both of these came out?
No.
You had two Johnny Depp star vehicles.
And
Steve
I love
Buscemi was considered.
I like that. I like that idea. Just because you can believe he's very put upon. Even though in real life he was a fucking firefighter. But I think he might, at this point, he might have been a little too old. As far as
Depp, I think he would have been certainly too old.
Yeah. As far as Depp goes, you know, I liked him around this time. I liked the choices he was making. Blow was the year before, which is probably one of my favorite movies of his. I wouldn't have believed him as a scientist.
And I'm sorry, I have this problem with Eric Bana. Johnny Depp's way too pretty to be a nerdy scientist.
Well, yeah.
Which is why I think Buscemi would have worked. Jeff Goldblum auditioned, but I would have just, this would have been The Fly, mm-hmm. and you would not have been able to escape that. Edward Norton, ironically, was interested, but he said no because he hated the script. Stop yeah. me if you've heard that before from yeah. Edward Norton. Tom Cruise was offered it, but he said no because he wasn't tall enough to get in the seat.
Tom Cruise was offered everything around this time.
And Cruise and Johnny Depp got the same apple boxes.
Yeah. I got to mention the one name that I thought would have been my choice. He auditioned. David Duchovny.
Yeah, I like that choice a lot as well. Yep. I would have liked that. That would have worked. But Ang Lee saw something in Bana. And, you know, here's the thing. Not only is he, as you mentioned, Matt, too pretty, but he's also like 6'4", 6'5". He's a tall guy. And so just him being that tall doesn't make him be the put upon individual that he's supposed to be. And I understand that Ang Lee is going for something different. This is about emotional repressed memories. I get it. It's not necessarily the nerd that we're going to be talking about, but you need Bana to be that in order for the Hulk to work. And I think Bana's trying. In all the behind the scenes stuff I watched, Bana's like, hello, love. He has a huge accent, which he gets rid of for this film. I respect that about him. I know he put in the work. I know he worked hard, but I don't think he always works as Bruce Banner.
I think he's the right choice in the wrong movie and the wrong director. I think Bana does a lot of good things. I got an issue with the voice because I'm so, and, oh God, what the hell did I watch recently? I can't even remember what movie it was, but it seems like whenever you got actors from Britain who are doing reshoots, all they can do is that hushed whisper to try to get the American accent out. And you know what? Hugh Laurie did every fucking episode without doing that hushed whisper bullshit. So I just get sick of it because I know he can't pull off the accent. I like Eric Bana. I think he's a good actor. I think he's in a lot of good things. And he is a good choice for Bruce Banner. But this script doesn't do him any favors whatsoever.
Well, 8 years after this, he would be a villain in Hannah, which is, I think, is an underrated assassin film. Yeah. The thing about this movie, too, you bring it up, Adam. I want to go ahead and say it right now, because otherwise I'll forget. I would have hated to be the ADR person in this movie, because there's so much.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my. I had to fucking.
Chris Nolan loves it.
People talk so quietly in this movie. There's whispers, and then don't even get me started on Nick Nolte. Not only does he talk quiet, you don't understand him half the fucking time. It is a tough movie. You have to have your TV all the way up, no matter what system you have, to understand it.
Okay, I almost thought it was me.
No.
I went into the control settings, and I maxed out my center channel to understand dialogue better. And I also had my closed captioning on, thank God.
Yeah, that's what I watched this movie with subtitles, just because I knew ahead of time that one of the things I remember about this movie is the ADR and how much of this movie is dialogue is difficult to decipher. It's almost like listening to Morse code at certain aspects. But my problem with Bana's performance, and I don't blame him entirely for this, is that the Hulk has to, because of the way Bruce is written, where he's repressing all of his memory, he also has to repress a lot of emotion, and he internalizes too much. Because of that, I can never fully empathize with him as a character. And it's kind of the Bill Bixby thing to a certain degree, where I don't fully like him, but I also know he's being directed to give a very specific performance. And I think he would have gotten this with almost anybody, you know, because the reason why I like Duchovny so much is I think Mulder's like theories, and he's very out there, that I could see that working for a different Bruce Banner, not necessarily the one that's here. But they try to make him Peter Parker because he's wearing a bike helmet, taking his bike to work. He works at Berkeley, the Nuclear Institute, with his girlfriend Betty, played by... Did Jennifer Connelly get a script that said A Beautiful Mind too? Because she's literally playing the same character, except she didn't get an Oscar for this one.
We talked about Halle Berry when she took Catwoman. That was her paycheck movie, right? This is Jennifer Connelly's paycheck movie. She did a couple of these. She did this. She did Dark Water a year later. First of all, and this is very surface level, but I have forgotten just how drop-dead gorgeous Jennifer Connelly is. She is so fucking beautiful in this movie. I just don't think they give her... The stuff that works is the stuff she does with her father, which I don't think there's enough of. I don't like the scenes really between her and Bana, and we'll talk about the third in that whole dynamic. But I love Jennifer Connelly being in this, but I'm not sure I like her Betty.
Yeah, I think she's a good... Especially at the time, I think she was a good actress to get for the role. I think she's underserved by the film.
I think the problem is they have acting chemistry because they're both talented, but they don't have any romantic chemistry.
Yeah, that's a big issue.
I never buy them as intimate partners. Part of it's also because they're both repressed and introverted to such a degree that it's hard to get that. And I think she was a good choice. And I don't think it's a paycheck as much as like you read Ang Lee directing. Mm-hmm. I would jump at the chance to work with that, especially because post-Oscar, yep, she could do whatever movie she wanted.
Absolutely.
It's also the problem. I hate movies where it's we just cast two pretty people and we're supposed to sympathize with them because they're tortured. That's why I hate A Beautiful Mind so much, on top of numerous reasons. And she's playing the same role of just stand by your man no matter what, even though he's clearly mentally unwell.
Mentally unwell. And don't forget, too, we never see these people happy. We're seeing them...
Yeah, all I need is one flashback of them, yes, genuinely happy, like at a movie or a dinner. We don't get that. Even the flashbacks we get, they're still undercut by this feeling of sadness.
There is nobody happy in this film.
Well, there's someone who's happy, and he sticks out like a sore thumb, which is the third wheel. The third wheel, Talbot, who comes in, played by Josh Lucas, who, I have a theory. His career went to shit because Bradley Cooper came around. Because a lot of Bradley Cooper's early roles, like Wedding Crashers and Midnight Meat Train, Josh Lucas probably would have played. And he is way too smarmy,
yeah,
for a movie that is this downtrodden. Like, he's playing it up too much.
Yeah, he did League and Lawyer with Matthew McConaughey. And it's just funny having those two in the same movie, because you have Matthew McConaughey and you have the guy who wants to be Matthew McConaughey. If there's one character and one actor I hate in this movie, it is Josh Lucas, a.k.a. Talbot. Talbot is directly from the comics. He's from a very early run of the comics, and I remember those very well. He is the foil for Bruce, but goddamn, I've never liked Josh Lucas in any movie. In this one, you're right, Matt. He's too smarmy, and anytime he's on screen, I want him off.
It's funny, because I think the only reason he's here is because they needed somebody, and Jennifer Connelly goes, wait, I know this guy from A Beautiful Mind. This Jesus Christ. I feel like he's one of the Volturi from fucking Twilight. It's that fucking hair. We weren't frosting our tips and, oh no, Justin Kelly. I guess we were frosting our tips in 2003, but you weren't doing it in a freaking nuclear lab in the hills
like
of Berkeley.
Yeah, like this guy's a government, like a major in the military, and he's the head of a private research company. And
well, he's supposed to be.
Haircut at Supercuts.
They don't spell out his role in this other than antagonist A.
Yeah, exactly.
the better version of this is Guy Pearce in Iron Man 3. Like, he's introduced the same way, the ex-boyfriend.
And he looks about as ridiculous.
He opens up a research firm. They look similar hair. He tells Betty, I'm here on behalf of your father. And she says, like, I don't speak to him anymore. And that's where we find out that her father is the colonel who was involved with David Banner. I got to say, Sam Elliott is a perfect casting choice.
I agree.
For Ross. And I think he's probably my favorite person in the movie.
Yeah, he, like Nick Nolte, took the movie before reading the script because Ang Lee was directing. That's how much clout Ang Lee had at this time. And yeah, I agree with you. I love the scenes between him and Connolly. I don't like Betty when she's with Banner, but I love her when she's with her dad, and I don't think we get enough of them.
I think he may be the only person appropriately cast in this entire film.
Oh, there's another one.
Sam Elliott, beef. It's what's for dinner. I mean, he is the right Thunderbolt Ross. To this day, he's the right Thunderbolt Ross.
Dude.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you watch, like, The Big Lebowski. And exactly. He doesn't even crack a smile once.
Exactly.
But like, you got between him and J.K. Simmons, I guess if he had a mustache, like, they got the perfect casting for both.
Yeah, who I guess they were looking at him to be Simmons in the Amazing movies and before they removed that character from the script.
And he said he based it on, you know, he actually read some Hulk comics because Ross is one of the more prominent characters. They had not yet done Red Hulk in the comics yet, so he was still just the general who was the... It's every guy's worst fear, the father-in-law from hell. the disapproving father-in-law who, in this instance, has legitimate axe to grind, not against the kid as much as the father, for perfectly valid reasons, as we'll come to find out. As Betty's leaving the lab one day, she runs into who she thinks is the janitor, and we get fresh off his arrest for Special K Nick Nolte as David Banner. And you can tell he was strung up during this production.
Well, he was arrested during the filming of this movie. Let's get that out there. He grew his hair long for this, and I think he's great. I love every time Nick Nolte's on the screen in this. But again, you can't really understand him when he talks. But I think the way he's playing off Eric Bana is fucking tremendous. I just sense that anger and jealousy in him every single time he talks. And goddamn, it's so hard to think of now, Adam. But remember, he was a sex symbol. He had been People Magazine's Sexiest Man of the Year in 1991, just 12 years before this. And here he is 12 years later. And my God, yeah, arrested during the filming of this, where that just that famous photo of him in that Hawaiian shirt. It's something to behold to watch him in this movie. I think he's, I'm not going to say fun. There's nothing about this movie that's fun again, but it's just funny watching him in this movie.
Damn it, Reggie. He brings a character to life. I will give it that. Look, I understand he took this role because of what he saw in it, and that's great. I don't think that role belongs in this film. I don't. Like, I get it. He's a man who's been hurt by the world. He thinks it's his King Lear. And at the end of this film, they basically just put on a stage production for like 8 minutes.
Oh, yeah. It becomes an Aaron Sorkin play.
But did Heron makeup just not ever show up to his trailer? Because
I think they were scared to.
He stuck his finger in a light socket and he looks disheveled the whole movie enough that it's awkward. At no point does he ever find a fucking comb. It's just, look, he does something here, and it's not that I don't appreciate it, because I think he does good work. I don't know why it's in my Hulk movie, other than Ang Lee working some shit out.
Well, I like that we have a movie about two abusive parents to varying degrees, one literal, one more metaphorical, trying to control their children. I think that I like that through line. I like comparing him to Ross, even though they despise each other. They're really the same guy in a lot of ways. That always makes for interesting villains. And I think each like parent-sibling relationship is really fascinating, but I don't feel like they give the Rosses anywhere near as much interesting material as the Banners.
You know what? I think I figured it out. This needs to be part of the sequel. You need to set up Bruce and Ross. You need to set up that. And then you need to bring up that this dad and Ross have this history later. It just doesn't fit here. Because this is no longer Bruce's movie, really. I mean, it kind of is, but your two antagonists are against each other. They're not even against Bruce for half of this.
Well, it is Bruce's movie because it's all about his repressed memories that gets that character that we're really looking for out. And Matt, you didn't mention it, but I want to go ahead and say we get the cameos out of the way, don't we?
Oh yeah, right. This is one of the earliest Stanley cameos with him and Lou Ferrigno walking out of the office going, security needs to be upgraded.
Right? I love these cameos.
Such a great cameo.
It's awesome. Yeah.
For both of them. And uh-huh. Ferrigno looks massive.
Yeah, he does. And just having Stanley just talk, I mean, I don't know if you guys ever went to cons that he was at. This is the way he was. Like, you would see him at a con, he would talk your fucking ear off. You would never be able to get a word in. Such an affable, likable man. And yeah, this was great to see. I remember being in theaters, and Adam, you always make the mention of Leonardo DiCaprio and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but that's how I was in the theater. Like, oh, look.
Well, it's also one of the only ones at the time where he spoke dialogue.
Yeah.
More often than not, he was doing just reaction shots, or he was a bystander in a crowd. This one, no, he's got actual dialogue, and I thought this was also a nice way to pay respect to Ferrigno, especially since Bixby was no longer with us. Mm-hmm. We got to pay tribute to the show. But we see that Banner and Betty are working on some kind of research. They don't 100% say what it is. All we see is an exploding frog. Like it's like putting a gremlin in a microwave.
That's what I thought of.
Looks like it too.
Which, again, like, if you're an Amble lover, you're going to despise this
movie. Yeah.
But okay. So I know we always have to come up with ways to contrive superheroes getting their powers, but I do like that he has to save his colleague from getting an accident, but I'm like, you had more than enough time to get in the other room before the Gamosphere went off. Like, I'm sorry. They make 15 seconds seem like a full minute.
They do. They're elongating it. But before we get here, I do want to mention another thing about Ang Lee's direction here. We talked about Nolte. There's just a way that Lee is telling this story that is just magnetizing to me, in that at one point we're seeing Nick Nolte look through a microscope. And then he transitions from that to a swooping shot of green trees, right? Again, green, always being in the frame, right? And we go right from those trees to Bruce Banner on a fucking bike as he's riding to work. Right there, guys. Right there. We have the entire story being told right in front of us. We have the two main principal players, and we have the thing that is in between them, which is this huge green thing that we're going to see throughout the course of this. I watched the movie twice for this review, and just stuff like that really stuck out to me, and people were not ready for that kind of storytelling at this time in their big budget superhero film. And when I watched it now, like, I respect it a lot more than I did in 2003.
I admire it more than I like it. Like, he was clearly trying to make like an art house superhero film well before that was passé to do. But he's doing it with the character that it makes the least amount of sense to do it with.
True.
You know, the Hulk's expectation and why he works so well is as a mindless monster. There's been exceptions. Like, people wanted to see the Hulk punch shit. It's the Superman Returns argument. Superman, there wasn't enough punching in my Superman movie. Although that movie has other problems that we talked about a couple years ago. Here, I just think this would have been better suited for a character. I could see this approach working really well for if someone was doing a different take. Like, if Bryan Singer didn't do X-Men and this was the style and the approach you went with, given the science components and talking about mutation and genes, that you have literal genes and a figurative gene. But I just question doing it with the Hulk. Like I said, I think that's the biggest misstep is doing it with this character.
Fair enough. Would it have worked with Terminator if you had taken
that film? Yes. I think it would have.
I agree.
Now, I like the T3 we got, but it would have been a very different movie. I think it would have been much more cerebral, because Terminator 3, for its problems, it's much more of a straightforward action film than even 2 by a certain margin. But Banner touches the Gamosphere and it malfunctions. We get like this flash of green and he wakes up in a hospital bed, feeling more alive than ever. He's even told, like, there's no way you should have survived that because the nanomeds killed everything else. He says, my bad knee is now my good knee. Although we've never seen him walk with a limp or any discernible deformity, so I found that line to be very awkwardly put in. This script clearly feels like it was written by 20 different people and had 100 drafts that were just meshed together.
That is one thing I will definitely say negatively about this film, is you see all these visions at once in this film, and it throws the movie off. Tonally, the movie is completely off due to that. And James Shamus, who was Ang Lee's direct co-writer at this time, he worked with him exclusively. Even he just couldn't parcel all of this stuff out and make it into a very coherent script, because the script is all over the place.
And again, like, we're told that they have a romantic past, and clearly they're not together at this point, but I needed more time with them and establishing who they are, what they were before getting to this point. Because all I see and all I buy are just two work colleagues who I needed the meet cute from the fly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking of a lot. Like a Cronenberg Hulk movie I could have totally seen if he ever agreed to do it, which I think there's no chance in hell he would have.
No. Yeah, you know what? That's a great point. Make them meet here instead of being broken up and already having bad memories of each other. Yeah, I agree with that approach. That would have worked.
While he's asleep, David goes into Bruce's room and tells him, Luke, I am your father for all intents and purposes, because Banner believes both his parents are dead. I like how foreboding and ominous he is about teasing what's inside him, because even he doesn't know what's the finished result going to look like. It's just he knows that he passed something on. And I like one thing this movie does very well that I have to compliment. They earn the first Hulk transformation.
Definitely. Also, Nick Nolte's just kind of lingering around in this film, right? He's always around corners. And
yeah, I think he just drunkenly showed up on set and they rolled camera to be like, all right, let's see what he does. And then we'll edit around.
Well, when I watched it for this podcast, you know, when this had come out, it was in theaters. I did buy the DVD and I watched the DVD repeatedly. I've seen this movie about a dozen times at this point, two more times for this podcast. And one thing I will say is I always thought that it was David Banner, his dad, who actually caused this accident because of who he wanted to create. But no, this accident just kind of happens. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake to not have David Banner be the one who causes the accident that turns Bruce Banner into the Hulk.
I think it's a mistake that it just happens by chance.
Yeah.
You know, right. There's just something goes wrong and that's all to get to it. But we went through it. I got a big problem with him just standing in front of these, I don't know, gamma tubes. It's not a gun. They don't shoot it out in a straight line standing in front of them. No, that entire room gets engulfed with gamma. So
yeah, they should all be incinerated.
There's just like, stuff that I'm, like, I understand they're trying to just get there. But guess what? We get 42 minutes before we get a Hulk. We're a third of the way in this movie before we get your titular character. It's earned, like it looks good, but get there. And I don't like the way that it's done. And none of this stuff makes any sense. Hey, you made some cool looking radioactive symbols that turn. And, you know, production design's pretty damn good in this film. I'll give it that. But I live in this area, so I know this area. And with a bad knee, he's not riding his bike up hills to where that laboratory is.
Nope.
It looks better than it looks better than it's written. I guess I'll say that.
Well, I don't like that they go as far as making the impetus for the Hulk inside him the whole time at his father's self-inflicted doing. But they don't go to the full extent of, like, him cutting the cord on the gamma sphere, especially since you've established he's working there as the janitor and has access to the technology. Why not just go all the way? Like, because if this didn't happen, then his plan doesn't come to fruition.
Yeah. Was he just going to hang out there hoping for an accident?
Yeah. Was he going to make him slip and fall without putting up a wet floor sign and that would have triggered the Hulk? I don't understand what he was fully banking on. But Betty's also told that, you know, your father wants to talk to you. And we get a very awkward dinner scene where, again, I like that they're estranged and she can read that he's just using her to get to Bruce. She gets up and leaves. But you can see he's trying to get that relationship, but she can just read him like a sheet of paper.
I've eaten at this restaurant.
Oh, have you?
I know where this is. This is downtown. I can't remember if it's Emeryville still or Berkeley. I think it's still technically Emeryville. But I looked out those windows and I went, holy shit, I've eaten here for a buffet. They do a really nice Sunday brunch right on the water.
And she also calls Bruce after dinner and he goes back to the lab. Or I say he's still in the lab. He gets out of the bed. She calls him, leaves a voicemail basically saying my dad's sniffing around. Which this is also weird because part of the twist in this movie is that Talbot and his research company Atheon take over the military, even though he's a subordinate of Ross. It's never fully explained. What is this lab doing? What is their purpose of their research? At least in Oscorp, they specifically mention the Goblin technology as weapon development. Which is what Atheon wants, because he talks about, you know, regenerating soldiers. And I was thinking, are you trying to tie this into Wolverine?
Like, they do everything but call them super soldiers or Weapon X. Yep.
Because they probably would have been sued if they used super soldier, although it didn't stop them before in a goddamn Man-Thing movie. Yeah, so this is where the talk with his father combined with the voicemail from Betty causes him to go into a state of anger. And we get the first Hulk transformation, which is largely shot in the dark. You can't fully tell what he looks like yet. And the one thing I like about this movie, I should say the one thing, because that makes it sound exclusive. I like how people watch the Hulk transformation through different lenses. Father's watching it through the door. Talbot watches it firsthand later on. Ross watches it on a monitor. Like, I like that everyone gets different perspectives on the actual Hulk transformation.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, 40 minutes is a while to wait. And for 2003, I don't think this is terrible.
All right. Let's get into the Hulk effects. I think in the dark, I think it looks good. And I'm with you. I think for 2003, this looks pretty damn good. However, ILM, I know they were doing George Lucas Star Wars movies around this time. I don't know if their attention was fully on this. I know Dennis Muren was working on this. I don't think the face looks right. I don't think the hair looks right. I don't like the manifestation of Eric Bana in this Hulk. And he's too fucking green. There's some things about it I do like. I like the fact that as he gets angrier, he gets bigger. He goes from 9 feet to 12 feet to 15 feet. That's pretty awesome. But, and we'll talk about dogs here in a bit, but I think the CGI effects for the most part aren't really up to 2026 standards. And I think they're barely up to 2003 standards.
I think it looks better more than it doesn't. I like that it doesn't look like Eric Bana in the face. I'm kind of glad about that. I like the hair. It gives it a little more of a Frankenstein look. The color changes a little bit. I get it. I don't like that he changes size within this one scene. I understand later it explains why he changes sizes, but even here before he escapes the building, he keeps shrinking and growing. Bugs me. But I like the transformation. I think he looks pretty good. There's a couple scenes later that look like a cutscene from a video game, but I think here it works out. I think it does pretty dang good.
I think one thing Ang Lee does that's really good is when he's transformed here, the sprinkler system in the building is turned on. So he gets out of the way the fact that this Hulk is here, because instead of it being a manifestation that doesn't interact with anything, we're having water spray on him, and we all know how bad water can look. But the fact that it's in the dark makes it look cooler when he's walking around and the water spraying on him. So that was a nice touch.
So my thought on the design, I agree with Garrett on some things and Adam on others. Sorry to play the middle band, but gotta call it like I see it. I don't like that it's looks nothing like Eric Bana. And I also don't like, we didn't talk about this, I don't like that Ang Lee felt the need to do the motion capture himself.
Yeah.
Because that really makes Eric Bana feel like the third wheel. It's the visual effects team. It's Ang Lee doing the motion capture. Then you have Eric Bana just playing Bruce. So as a result, I feel like there's a huge disconnect between the two characters. Maybe that was intentional because you had Bixby and Ferrigno clearly separated. But it also makes Eric Bana here just to be Bruce. As a result, I don't feel like this Hulk is the extension of his id the way the character should be, and especially with how they're trying to depict this Bruce Banner.
Thank you for bringing this up. In watching those behind the scenes vignettes, it is funny. I do have to say, it is funny watching Ang Lee, this little Asian man, do all these Hulk movements with the suit on and the ping pong balls. All of it is fun to watch because he does say, he's like, look, I have my own interpretation of it. I have my own vision of it. And if I'm going to do that vision, I want to do it myself and not have somebody else do it. I can respect that to a point, but I think Matt is right. I think this works to the movie's detriment because I'm getting no personification of Eric Bana here. I'm just seeing this motion capture being done by this director, and there's a real disconnect between the two characters.
I get it, but I think they're trying to make it two different characters. I think this entire thing being about duality and being about Jekyll and Hyde, with that I'm okay with it.
Well, it is, but it's also asking the question, like, was the Hulk here all along?
Yeah. Or
is this truly who Bruce was destined to be? So I think sometimes the movie is at odds with even its own messaging. But
because of that, I will say, and we touched just a little bit earlier, I can't stand that David Banner is the reason that Bruce is the Hulk. I hate that choice.
So you don't like that the aspect, whole like predetermined
aspect? I can't stand anything having to do with his father in this for the most part.
See, I like most of it. I wish they kept it to just the... Look, they seriously insinuate he was abusive. Like, he takes the pacifier out of the kid's mouth.
Yep.
That's the most blatant thing we see. Thankfully, we don't see anything beyond that just for the sake of... There's no way this would have gotten a PG-13 rating if they had to show the things that they're insinuating occurred. But I don't like in superheroes' origins when we have to take the origin out of complete randomness and trying to tie everything together. That's why I always hate in Spider-Man where they try to do like a Destiny thing, which they've done multiple times. I talked about this with some of the Punisher adaptations. I don't like having Frank Castle be like the victim of a conspiracy or aspects like that. I like the Hulk being clearly a metaphor for his dark side and his being triggered by what his father put him through. But I, at the same time, don't like the literalization of he was actually experimented on and it's his DNA that was passed down. That, I think, is trying to make everything way too literal in a movie that's also trying to be very metaphorical. But like I said, though, I can't knock the ambition. That's the one thing I will give this movie credit for, is that it took swings that no other film in the genre had done since Batman Returns, as far as like, this is clearly the director's movie, and the studio, outside of all the mandates and changes with the script, kind of feel like they're only here for the marketing aspect. And you can tell he likes King Kong, because they literally do the thing of him putting his face on the Hulk.
Yep.
Betty and the Hulk, that might as well be Anne and Kong in all the earlier versions. And the mocap technology, while I don't like that Ang Lee did it, I think it's still, I mean, outside of this, we only had Gollum, really.
Yeah, that was the bar that was set the year before. And I don't think it even reaches that plateau, quite honestly.
No, I don't think so either. Part of it, that is also you have an actor doing the mocap versus a director. Because I'm trying to think, like, you think of the Avatar movies, you never see James Cameron in a mocap suit. Although I think if he did, he would give a better performance than Sam Worthington.
Let's take yet another jab at Sam Worthington.
Oh, I will never stop taking shots at that. I mean, look, you got one Australian in this movie trying to be American, which is another thing that bothers me. I'm like, if you're going to have him do an accent, put on an American accent, just cast an American or make Bruce Banner Australian like he's an exchange student. That would explain it. He got away from his father by moving as far away as possible.
Yeah, I do like what he was going for. I like the fact that Ang Lee talks about the fact that the reason he cast Eric Bana was because there's a dark side behind those eyes. And I can see it to an extent, but I think it doesn't really come out in this movie. Except when Ang Lee's in the mocap suit pretending to.
And the Hulk breaks out of the lab, and they sort of do like the Bill Bixby show where he wakes up and doesn't remember any of it because this guy represses so much, he might as well be living in like a hyperbolic chamber where he just shuts himself off from everybody. He might as well be sleeping in the thing that Barrett Affleck's Daredevil did and just not interacting with everybody. But Betty goes to check on him at his house. Ross and the military show up and they question him, and he says, if you come within 1,000 yards of my daughter ever again, I'm going to put you away for the rest of your natural life. And he realizes that while he's clearly unstable, he realizes that Banner is repressing what actually happened. So again, they're trying to reinforce the repressed memories and that Ross knows what happened, but we as the audience know he killed the mom. There's no ambiguity for that at all. So why are we dragging it out?
Yeah.
Because I have that problem too. I think a lot of the reveals in this movie could have been done a lot earlier.
I agree.
And I applaud the ambition, like I said, but this thing is too damn long.
You can only do this repressed memory thing for so long in a comic book film before it... Hell, even Singer knew when to pull back on that the few years before this. It does go too long.
The difference with that also is it's part of Wolverine's character.
Yeah.
He has amnesia.
I know, but you know what I'm saying. Like, for the audience's sake, you need to pull back from it because you're turning way too much of your audience off.
That's also nothing. Between Hugh Jackman and Eric Banner, we're casting Australians to play our superhero. I can't say R because Wolverine's Canadian, but...
Jesus.
It was a trend. We get these handsome Australians playing our superheroes. They look like models. They don't look like actual like people you would see. That's why I like Tobey Maguire's casting as Spider-Man. We'll talk about his performance in 5 years, but he's not a movie star, good-looking guy.
I like Doug Ray Scott as Wolverine. Oh, wait, that didn't happen. We talked about that last year.
That happened in the multiverse. Maybe that was repressed by Fox for good reason. But he's placed under house arrest, and they interrogate him. Ross seizes the lab, and David calls Bruce that night. And, okay, one of the things that this movie, I think, is most infamous for are the dogs, which are routinely teased. He's got three dogs, like a poodle. I think there's, like, a bloodhound, and there's one other one that David just has with him at his house in his facility. He experiments on them, and he reveals that he's sending his pets after Betty. And I wish he just said it rather than us actually seeing it. Because while a lot of the Hulk effects you can justify as being good at the time, even in 2003, these Hulked out dogs look like garbage.
Yeah, this looked like it belonged on my PS1 screen. I like the fact that we have waited this long and we're getting a fight. I think that was the right impulse, even if it was a little too late. And I know they worked really hard on this sequence. If you watch those vignettes, they worked for months, but the technology just wasn't up to par. And yeah, these dogs look really fake, and it kind of takes you out, quite honestly. Even the Hulk fighting these things, it just doesn't look right. And you know what? And I want to give praise to people. Like, if you had hired like a Michael Bay or somebody like that, they would have made sure that these effects work. They would have made sure that they're not just given the once over. The ironic thing is, and I remember laughing about it, is when Ang Lee won the Oscar for Life of Pi years later, it was for something that had to do with all these visual effects that he was kind of getting the jump start on with this. And I like the fact that he went for it, but this is when I would have gone for a more action-oriented director to get this right.
What I can't stand is that there's a lot of stuff I like in the lead up to this. When Hulk is hiding behind that giant tree, I think it's a really good moment. This one, when he shows up with these dogs earlier, one, who brings three different dogs to work as a janitor? But look, this is 2000. We had The Matrix. We had other stuff that had happened. So I am not excusing these effects whatsoever. Nor am I going to excuse that you have mutant dogs in this and thought that it was fun or funny or a proper mid-movie battle. This is just dumb. I can't excuse it. I can't. As a kid, as an adult, like, this is just stupid.
That's the other big thing, is that this is such a disconnect from the seriousness of the movie. You're having them fight like giant dogs. And it also is the problem of, we were still not fully able to integrate cute computer characters with practical sets just yet. Without having a base like the animatronic T-Rex or the Raptors to play off of that you can insert later. Jennifer Connelly's having to act against nothing. They just put her in a car and have her staring at stuff like a goldfish.
I think what's harder is you have three of them. You know what? Have one that you could spend some time and money on. But I don't need this Cujo scene with Jennifer Connelly, with this dog in the car. Though I at least laugh when, at the end of the day, they just explode into a green mist.
Yeah.
That's almost like ILM going, fuck it. You know what? They turned into Jar Jar Binks. I give up.
Well, that's the other thing. Also, it's like, you can't, to your point, Gollum, you can see the seams nowadays, but you still have to marvel at the technology at the time. Mm-hmm. This, I think, has aged considerably worse, and it came out a couple months after. And look, I understand, but comparing this to like the end of Blade, I think it looks better than that, because that has the same problem where you have like real practical stunt work and sword play, and then it's inserted with cartoon visual effects. Like, this is so outlandish for this very serious movie. Like, this feels like something that Adam West this is bat shark repellent.
That's a great comparison, actually. And Adam West Batman does not belong in your thematic huge ass fucking Hulk movie. I'm sorry.
And we also skipped over a scene of like when Betty goes to Banner's house and he's living like a bum, and he tells her like, Bruce is unique and you don't understand him. And there's that creepy part where you think he's gonna like get into this, rape her. But he just takes her jacket to get the scent to track her.
Yep.
So I'm glad they don't go that far, because we already know this guy is a murdering scumbag, and they pull back on that. But I like that scene's actually pretty suspenseful, and it carries over here. That's the one thing I like about this movie also, is that the Hulk is treated as foreboding and scary, even when he's not really going to attack you. I like, though, that also people react to the Hulk like you logically would. Except for his father, but you have the excuse he's insane. He's Dr. Frankenstein for a lot of this, if he got on a bend and forgot to go to a stylist. But yeah, I think also this fight is just, you could have had him fight something else, or just cut this.
And by the way, this is straight from the comics. He does fight Hulk dogs in comics. He fights Hulk sharks.
But again, what works in a comic doesn't translate
to screen. It doesn't. I'm not saying it does. There's
a lot of really stupid shit in comics, especially in Marvel in the 90s.
You're not kidding. And I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying, you know, they're pulling from the source. So I like the instinct. I think this is my review of the entire movie. I like the instinct, but it's the wrong instinct for this film.
Yeah, especially because this Hulk fight is triggered by Talbot showing up at his house.
Well, yeah.
And it's funny, this reminded me the whole house fight where the cops are shooting at him. This is the scene with Pyro from X2. It's a very weird coincidence that these came out like a month apart, yep. and it's almost the same scene. And when we see Talbot showing up looking like Jimmy from South Park later on with the crutches and the cast, I'm like, why? He should be dead if he's that injured for him to be walking around considering what the Hulk does to him. He takes out the dogs because Betty had gone to their cabin, which we've seen in flashbacks.
I swear I've seen this cabin.
Yeah, I think this is where Dave Bautista captured that couple from nothing.
But I will say, as somebody who lives where this movie is set, there is no place where this river and cabin exist up here in the Bay Area.
Yep, I don't know where they took off to. This is the problem when you get non-American directors who think the whole country looks exactly the same.
Berkeley looks down on the San Francisco, Oakland area. There's not a cabin in the woods area. It's closer to Garrett than it is San Francisco.
I was thinking Tahoe, yeah.
They should be in St. Paul, Minnesota, or some, or like the New England, where cabins like this are pretty prevalent. No, it's also the thing of, like, again, we took a New York, the Hulk is not defined by New York as much as other characters, but took to the West Coast for no reason. The prologue of this movie takes place in the desert. Like, they live in, like, New Mexico, it's nuclear.
I took it he was trying to tie it into Los Alamos, which is in Livermore, which is here in the Bay Area, Berkeley Labs. And their West Coast Avengers exists. I get it, but yeah.
Yeah, because I'm sure that was on their mind when they made this movie. We got to set up other characters. Because, like, that's another thing. Like, even Spider-Man, they were setting up other opportunities down the road. This one's not really preoccupied with establishing a larger universe, which I do admire, because Ang Lee is looking at this as a singular film. But there's not a whole lot of fun Easter eggs that I caught in this, outside of the "you wouldn't like me when I'm angry" line.
Which is told in a different language.
Yeah. But I also like that Betty sells him out but feels bad about it. Like, she's not I like that she's not vindicated for doing this, because they shoot Banner with a freaking dart and he passes out. They take him to a desert base, and this is where Ang Lee goes full overboard with the freaking panels. Like, I think this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree.
Especially because they're dragging him out of the helicopter in this giant tube that made me think of the Tom Cruise Mummy, where they're hanging the sarcophagus outside of the helicopter, and that's not the movie I want to be thinking of watching this. Here's also where it gets a little bit murky, because now Talbot has taken over the whole operation. Even though he can barely walk, he's trying to get Bruce to Hulk out by electrocuting him with the cattle prod. And I like the scenes with Connolly and Ross, Sam Elliott. Me I think too. They're really good together, where they're arguing about, like, he's basically doomed to follow in his father's footsteps, not determined. And agreed. He clearly doesn't want to.
Yeah, I think both of them are good actors, and I think they elevate each other when they have a scene together.
And Betty says, like, let her try, and he's very reluctant to do it. But as we find out, he only has so much pull now because it's become Talbot's operation. Meanwhile, we got David Banner has somehow replicated the technology, and this is where they basically took the Absorbing Man from the comics and David Banner and merged them into one character, because now he can absorb whatever element he touches and replicate it. But we only see him do this to set up the climax.
Yeah. Oh boy, that climax.
So which means that whatever he was working on, he did give it to himself, but the reactions for himself are different than the reactions from Bruce. So it's just random. Okay. Reasons.
Yeah. It's like an X-Men where you just get powers from being exposed to it. It doesn't matter what they are.
Oh, it is very much like what they do to that senator.
Yeah, it's very
we're going to expose you to this. Oh, yeah. Shit.
I think there are certain aspects of this that were kind of like groupthink from things they had done previously.
Yeah.
From other movies. But that's the other thing also. Like, the more comic book aspects of this feel really out of place, which is odd in a Hulk movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, having a guy who can absorb, like, floor tiles, and he gets superhuman strength because he crushes the guard with the power breaker, picks it up and slams it on him. So this also gives him superhero strength. Like, this, I think, from here is where I start to agree more with Adam that David Banner's characterization gets thrown out the window. Like, I think I start to turn on him here. So Talbot tells Ross that he's taken over. He tells Betty to go home. So Talbot tries to get Banner to Hulk out. He puts him in the tank, which I was getting Avatar flashbacks here.
Very much so. Now, for anybody who's been to the Islands of Adventure at Universal Florida, you'll recognize, because part of the queue for the Hulk coaster, which is one of the best freaking coasters, is this underground area. So that popped me quite a bit. That was cool.
And you see the names of Ross and Talbot on the wall and Stryker. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really cool Easter eggs. More Easter eggs in the ride than there are in this movie. And honestly, I'd rather go on the ride 50 consecutive times, which would make you probably concussed and nauseous than rewatch this again, to be perfectly honest. But this is where, by hooking him up, this is also the scene in The Exorcist where they hook Reagan up to the technology in the hospital. And here he realizes that, oh, my father killed my mother. To which I said, okay, you didn't put two and two together now that your father has reinserted himself and clearly has bad intentions. And it's also here where we find out that it's just bad emotion, seemingly, that causes the Hulk, not anger exclusively.
But this whole David Banner, he was going to kill Bruce.
Yeah.
Or at least attack Bruce. Like that.
He says, like, I was going to do like the merciful thing a father would do.
So this whole, I don't know, like David is never you at least want to understand your villains a little bit. I don't know, maybe somebody can. There's nothing in David where you're like, yes, I can identify there. I don't get it. But then with Bruce in the tank, okay, he's having a bad dream. I don't know how they get a dream out of him by putting him in the Avatar tank and shocking him, and or that he knows he has a dream. Oh, that's a big dream. This is just Hulk out and get smashy. And I can't believe I'm the one saying that, but less talky, more smashy.
Well, it's here. He does get out of the tube and they try to contain him by using sticky foam, which this is also does not look good because the color of the foam mixed with the Hulk, you just got two CGI blobs integrating with each other. It looks ridiculous.
This gives me what might be my favorite scene of the movie, though, because they put in this gas to knock him out, and you think he's going to get knocked out, and he sneezes. And I audibly laugh aloud when that happened. They gave me something like just that kind of, thank goodness I could actually laugh somewhere in this film.
Well, they needed more moments like that. Small, like clear undercurrents of intentional comedy. And it catches you so off guard that you laugh harder than you should, because it also doesn't mesh with the rest of the movie. What it does mess with is, I think, the worst transition in this movie.
Oh, my goodness.
Hulk grabs the grenade launcher. Now, I like the logic that it just bounces off the Hulk, because he's got like impenetrable skin, which they established, because they can't inject him. But the grenade explodes, and Talbot, there's a freeze frame of him behind fire, jumping in the air. This looks horrible. It's cartoony and it's stupid.
It looks really bad.
But you're wondering how I got into this situation.
Yeah, I have expected Ron Howard to start narrating. It's an Arrested Development reference for those of you who don't get it. But
thank you. I had no idea.
So this is where Ross resumes command. The Hulk escapes. And if you want Hulk action, you got a good 15 minutes of the Hulk just taking on the military.
Yeah, which I think also contributed to the Hulk's complete failure at the box office the following week, is because this was the wrong time to show the U.S. military being taken out. I don't care if it's a comic book character or not, because we were in the midst of a fight with Afghanistan and Iraq at this time. We had gone to war, and they really established, like, it turns into an episode of G.I. Joe, because there's one point where he goes to the tank and he's shaking it to make sure everybody's out of it, and then he throws it. This was the wrong time to do this kind of stuff.
I'll say, though, at least I'm excited. I kind of like these Airwolf helicopters that they have. That's all I could think of was Airwolf. Garrett knows what I'm talking about. Do. But at least there's something here, though. This is kind of random desert. They do G.I. Joe all of this. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody is safe. Even these helicopters that crash, and he's like stepping on them, but I'm okay, Joe.
Yeah,
I can get out in a minute. It's laughable. And, you know, you got a giant desert and you got four tanks show up. But you know what? You got Hulk ripping off a turret, swinging it, and holding it like a baseball bat. This is what you need in this movie.
I agree. Although, you know, years before, people were complaining, oh, it's out in the middle of nowhere, so we're making sure nobody gets hurt and no citizens get injured. Well, yeah, it's in the desert. But again, just when you go from watching news footage of the war going on, and then you go to a popcorn movie that not only has child abuse and repressed memories, but you're also seeing the Hulk just completely in the desert fighting soldiers, it kind of takes you out as well.
That's the other thing also, is this movie's tremendously imbalanced, where it's backloaded with all the Hulk. Because you got the last 30 minutes of this movie, I'd say the Hulk is in it for like 20 of it.
And yeah.
It's action. So it doesn't feel as well dispersed as it should be. It feels like too little, too late. And it's comic book accurate in a movie that, in large parts, the comic book elements don't feel as well integrated.
I agree. And you know, another thing I really like about this too is I love the way, and I know it's directly from the comics because I remember him doing it in the comics, but the hop that he does, like the way he jumps, you know, his legs are so strong that he can leap meters and meters and meters. That's all fun stuff.
Yeah, well, I think the way he's getting around it, the physics of the Hulk in this are actually pretty well thought out.
Yep, I know some people at the time complained because they're like, that doesn't make, no, not only does it, is it accurate, but I think it looks good. And I think it's right for even the Hulk in this movie, it's the right characterization.
And he's not as rubbery as I thought he'd be when he jumps, because that's one of my complaints about the first Raimi Spider-Man film, is there are parts where he looks like an action figure bouncing on shit.
Yeah, but again, he's too fucking green. They needed to dim this. And I made the complaint.
Yeah, I don't have that problem.
I know you don't, but Adam, am I right? I mean, that's way too green, isn't it?
I think my problem is it's inconsistent. His color seems to shift, and not shift like it does with his... with his size because of his mood. Like, it's just, and it's not because of the sun or lightness or darkness, it's just inconsistent. And yeah, his color is off, not massively, yeah, well, but on the big screen you kind of notice it.
Yeah, and it also stands out because it's nothing but desert in the background. It's all monochromatic in one color, so the fact that you have this green,
the same year they did a documentary on finding the color of Daredevil's leather, so you know. I swear to God, people,
because they don't want to have Betty be silent, she goes to see David and he says, I will turn myself in peacefully if I got to talk to Bruce one more time.
Okay, wait.
Right.
Before you get there. Okay, so much like King Kong, the thing that calms the beast is the woman, right? They bring the woman out, and yeah, we're seeing a morph of him going from the Hulk to Banna. And you know what? I had forgotten about that. I think that works pretty well. And this is where you cut it. We cut it right here.
Yeah, I feel like the movie's over. Like,
yeah.
Because this is also trying to clearly set up a sequel.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like there are notes from studio heads or something saying we need to resolve Banner and his dad. We need to get that resolved before the end of this. That's the only reason you do what you do at the very end of this movie. Because holy shit, do we go batshit crazy in the final 10-15 minutes of this film.
I will say, and I can confirm, the stuff here in, when he shows up in San Francisco, and that's where you're talking about, right? And he comes up through they're attacking him on, when they keep cutting between the Golden Gate Bridge and Bay Bridge because they don't know which one they shot, and the middle of them looked the same. But there was the scene of the Hulk and the destruction going down the hills of San Francisco. They changed it. Mm-hmm. And how do I know this? Because you don't see me on the sidewalk, because I was there for the filming of this, and they edited out a lot, almost all of them, for the people where you see nobody on the sidewalk. We were packed on the sidewalks, and it was supposed to be about Hulk and the destruction of the city, and suddenly there's nobody on the streets of San Francisco, which never exists. So they did some weird changes for reasons that are inexplicable to me.
Well, I don't think they wanted to show any more of the destruction than they needed to because of the war that was going on. That's my belief.
Mm. Would you say it was ultimate destruction? But, you know, the Hulk literally jumps to San Francisco. And she talks him down, which I'm sure this is in the comics, and we'll see this in the 08 film. We'll see this with Black Widow. The Hulk is under the thumb of a woman, and that's what calms him down in almost every version. So,
much see, like guys, fly, it is okay to tell a woman to calm down. Yeah. Sorry.
But this feels like the climax. Like, he's being transferred to like a prison or some kind of holding cell. He breaks out. And he goes away, and it ends on a cliffhanger, and you still have his father out there. You still have Ross after him. He's now a public fugitive because he's done property damage to San Francisco. The secret of the Hulk is now out. You have all these through lines you can do for future movies, but they also, on a justifiable level, weren't thinking about the F word at this point and said, no, we got to have full closure. So they go to the base where literally everyone's watching David and Bruce talk to each other, and I jokingly, this is a friggin' Aaron Sorkin play, where it's like static shots, it's just the two of them in frame, trying to talk about big topic things and repression. I don't want you, I want what's inside you, that's my actual son. I like this. And then they said, fuck it. Because he bites an electrical cable and becomes a giant.
What is that? Stop. When Nick Nolte picks up that cord and he bites completely into it, I remember being in the theater and audibly saying, what the fuck? What are we doing here?
I think this is one of the worst examples of they did not know how to end this movie.
Yep.
And this is one of the most haphazard, implausibly confusing fights I've seen. And look, we've had up to this point, let's look at the history. Blade, there's that huge contrast between the stunt work and the blood god at the end of that movie. First X-Men movie, they ran out of money, so you can kind of excuse some of the shortcuts they took. But you had Spider-Man end on a pretty satisfying fight.
Not really when you take into Green Goblin into effect, but we'll get there.
I'm talking about like the actual like fight itself. Like you can tell what's happening.
Yeah.
There's some really cool, like, part of it's also, it's this, you have two giant monsters fighting, which is, that's the first time they had done this, but this is where they get too in love with the Godzilla King Kong type of big kaiju fights, because I can't tell what the fuck is happening.
I can't either. And even right before that, you know, you're talking about the fact that this is an Aaron Sorkin play being played out. I just don't understand the instinct to, after seeing Hulk just take out these tanks and throwing cars around and all the cool action we saw in the lead up to this, now you're going to have two people talking for 10 minutes before, you know, or 5 minutes or however long this is. It felt like an eternity. And then we have this final fight. It just, the wrong impulse.
Adam, when you were watching this again, did you forget this is how the movie ended?
I remember these two having their moment going at it. I forgot that it's basically just them literally sitting on like a stage that is lit on a stage of two people talking to each other. And I think this scene is what Nick Nolte is here for. Because there's a moment where, you know, Nick Nolte famously is like, this is my King Lear moment. And he, when he's monologuing here, I feel it, you know, and he's, Nick Nolte is good here. Aaron has got nothing to do but whine in that freaking chair. But then when he's like, damn, I can't even get through it. But when Nick Nolte's making fun of him, he's like, just gets all in the chair. It's like an SNL skit.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought of too.
And then he's just like, I mean, it might as well be fine. I'll do it myself. And bites the, which earlier we saw him suck up gas randomly out of the gas tube. This is just Nick Nolte on a bender.
Oh,
and then, yeah, I guess we're just going to freaking, and let's remember this is going on. And this is a long scene of these two just talking. This thing goes on for a while. And it has to remind you that people are watching it, because every now and then it cuts to a screen for like 5 seconds and you're like, oh, that's right. Okay, they're watching this. And then we're just going to get flashes in the sky.
Yeah, you cut to Sam Elliott pacing back and forth going, I can't believe this is what I signed up for. Even he realizes how stupid this was, because he turns into a bubble and tries to like absorb all of his power, but he overloads him and he explodes.
Yeah. Ugh.
Now, like, you guys, you guys step in and say, like, hey, we need to come up with something better than this. And certainly more comprehensible, because visually it's ugly because it's in the dark. You got one guy who's green, you got a giant sepia tone bubble. The logic makes no sense. They're having him go in his head and they're like psychically talking to each other. Oh my God, this is one of the dumbest climaxes in a superhero movie. For a movie that's trying to be cerebral, this is the opposite. I would call this the R word if I could get away with it, but I can't.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think, it's like, are they going for Observing Man here? Are they going for any? No. This is just bonkers climax. And this is around the time, 14 years before this, Batman fought the Joker on top of a building. And when they asked Burton why we're doing this, and Burton's like, because it's in the script. Just go up these goddamn steps. We're feeling the same thing here, where we're just kind of going by the balls of our feet, not knowing where this is leading. And oh my God. Again, I'd seen this movie quite a number of times, so I knew this was coming. And every time the scene starts and I think, God damn, why didn't we end this thing 10 minutes before?
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen this. And I was like, okay, I'm sure it's not going to be as bad as I remember. And I was right, because it is a lot worse than I remember. As bad as you remember, it is that bad and then some. Especially because once it's father and son, once it's Bruce and Absorbing Man slash Zix slash whatever else they want to combine them together, you finally get the face off and you don't get it. You get still images in the clouds and then you get something you should probably never say to your parent, take it all. And he explodes.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's just, it's laughable. And they're both presumed dead because it's like Return of the Living Dead. We're just going to nuke everything at the end and take them all out, because, I mean, it might as well be a Resident Evil game for that matter.
Wish they nuke this movie. Nuke it from orbit.
And we cut to a year later where Ross calls his daughter and says, you know, he's trying to say, I'm checking up on you. And she's like, again, you're full of shit. I know you've wired my phone and bugged my laptop. And she's like, even if I did see Bruce, I bet I'm the last person you'd go see. So I like that she's not hiding him anymore. Like, she doesn't know if he's fully alive. And I like that their relationship is still not on a good note. Like, this movie doesn't have a happy ending, which I appreciate, but also that would have been tremendously ridiculous to have everything get resolved with a bow in a movie like this. But in a way, the movie does end on an interesting tease where Bruce, because, yeah, we totally bi. He's dead. He's working as a camp doctor in the jungle. His camp gets overrun by freedom fighters, and he tells the commander to not make him angry. We get a shot of the, you know, going up into the trees. You hear the Hulk yell, and that's how the movie ends.
And I do think Marvel kind of took from this. I do think this is like the only thing that is in continuity with the rest of Marvel, but we'll get there.
I mean, it's a better way to end the movie than the fight.
Yeah, you're right. And you know what? Again, like, I always forget about this final teaser, but I like it. You know, I like the fact that it's not exactly a happy note, but it's not the down note that we've been having for the last 2 hours, 15 minutes. I like the fact that we get the line out in, like, another language, but it's still, mm-hmm. it's a nice little Easter egg for fans of the character.
Yeah, it's a way to, like, again, you had Lou Ferrigno here, and now you got your the most famous thing from that show. Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing they don't do in this, he doesn't, like, his eyes don't turn white when he walks out. You thought they could have done. Maybe they do, but a lot of the transformations are in the dark, so you can't really tell.
But they do turn green here at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I do like. And, you know, the movie ends on that way. You hear the Hulk, you don't see him, and credits roll on the Hulk. This is before the days of post-credit scenes and all that nonsense. There's no real follow-up beyond this. The movie just ends and credits roll. So very spirited discussion on a very contentiously debated movie. And it sounds like we're kind of on similar wavelengths, but maybe not. Adam, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Hulk?
I wasn't looking forward to going back and seeing this, but I was looking forward to analyzing it a little bit and trying to find parts that I enjoyed, pick out pieces, hopefully get some insight as I went back to it some 20 plus years later after I've seen it. Because I have not watched it in 20 years. I can guarantee you that. Yeah, I can't stand this movie. It's pretty goddamn simple. I don't think the casting is bad. I actually like the people they cast, even though if I don't think they're the right casting for this movie. Sam Elliott's pitch perfect. Nick Nolte is cast wonderfully in an absolutely different movie. And Banya and Connolly are cast great for their roles with a different script. This thing had trouble written all over it from the start, from the amount of screenwriters that it had, to getting a director who wanted something different. I don't even know if he really knew what he wanted for this movie, to Marvel Universal trying to, you know, Universal is trying to come off of, damn, you know, Fox really had a hit with those X-Men movies. Let's do something with this green character that we have. But this thing is written poorly. It's acted inconsistently. It's shot not well. Its effects. Hey, I'll give ILM credit. Apparently they, in the 25 years since they started making this film, they still don't have the time or money they need for a lot of big budget movies. This thing is just a miss across the board. I want to find something to like in it, but it's very, very few and far between. I'm never going to get through this one again. I will not do it. Oh man. Hopefully this discussion you like, because we're all angry. I thought I was going to be nicer, but I'm not. This is a 3. I can't stand this film. It's a 3 on 10.
That's lower than I thought it'd be.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, Trouble might as well be a co-writer on this movie, given all the turmoil and changes. But Garrett, I got to ask you, you know, you've kind of been certainly down on it, but are you going to go as low as a 3?
I don't know if I've been that down on it, with the exception of the climax. You know, I got to say, I got to take a deep breath here, because I've been debating on what to give this film since we announced this retrospective. I'm of two minds of it, boys. I really am. On one end, I cannot damn a movie for being this fucking ambitious with such a well-loved character. At the same time, I cannot reward a movie that goes the places this movie goes without as much as an explicit reason why. Every single time I've passed judgment on this movie is after I've seen it 2 times. I watched it twice in theaters. I saw it once with my friends on that Thursday night. And then that weekend, I remember taking my brother, who is the same age as Matt. So he was probably around 9 or 10 around that time. And we went and saw this in theaters just so I can really get a solid stance on how I felt about it. And I really do like aspects of this film, and I think I've outlined the things that I do like. I like the directorial instincts that Ang Lee is displaying throughout the course of this. This is an art house picture being done with a comic book character. And Matt, you kind of took my thunder away last week when you ended last week's podcast by saying this is the end of an era, because it truly is. This is the end of artists being able to take these characters and doing what they want with their vision without as much as people telling them where and when to go with it. And on one end, I have to applaud that. On another end, it damns this movie. And that's my total review of this movie. I think there are instincts that are great for the wrong film. I think Ang Lee is trying to tell a Greek tragedy around this character, and some parts work very well. I think Jennifer Connelly's great, and I like the father characters in this a lot. But I can't go with a lot of where the plot goes, especially that finale. And that finale by itself docks this movie a full point. However, I want to go double Adam's score. I want to give this a 6. I'm not going to go as high as a 7 because I can't really call it a good film, but it's the next best thing. It's a very, very good try. Very good attempt. So 6 out of 10 for Hulk. Man, I wish I liked it more than I did, but I admire it for where it goes.
So I do have to correct one thing you said before I give my thoughts, and I'll let you rebuff it. You know, you said this is the end of an era, playing off of what I said with, like, artists with these movies. I think that's a stretch, considering 2 years from now we'd have Christopher Nolan taking Batman.
Okay.
Would you consider that then the start of a new era?
No, because Singer did it with X-Men. No, I'm not going to go that far, because I think Nolan didn't really have a... He had a vision for it, but I don't think it's as undistinct as Ang Lee takes this film. I think this has art house picture written all over it. You watch those Nolan Batman films, they aren't art house pictures. They are blockbusters wrapped around some very, very distinct themes. I don't think you can compare Nolan's Batman to Ang Lee's Hulk.
I don't think it's fair until you get to The Dark Knight. Then I think you can have that conversation, certainly based on scale and genre. And I know it's a different thing, but I think the era that this ends for me is me giving any shit about the Hulk. Like, this was the final stamp on me saying, I don't think I'm ever going to like this character. And the reason I say that is, having come off the Bixby show, the movies, of which most of them I had not seen, and then in conjunction with rewatching this, I just think the Hulk is such an impossible character to craft as a standalone character. But goddamn, I have to give Ang Lee, this is going to be the biggest backhanded compliment. This is the most audacious bad movie I've seen that doesn't go into, like, because it is pretentious by its very nature. But I don't think it's that loathsome type of pretense that I get from, like, Lady in the Water or Richard Linklater's Waking Life, some of Terrence Malick's films that I detest. Because I think this was done with the best of intentions. Like, I don't think this was Ang Lee trying to say, I'm better than the genre and I'm going to do my own thing. I just think he took it with the right mentality, with the wrong character. And I think that's my thesis statement on the movie. There's a lot here I like. And there's a lot of bold choices that I have to applaud in concept. Execution is another matter entirely. For a 2+ hour movie, there's a lot of meat here. There's plenty of material. But there's a lot of things that are not fleshed out, and there are several things that are inserted because they're part of the comic book tapestry, and Ang Lee doesn't know how to incorporate them. Not so much the editing, as much as the need to have a big showdown with your villain that I think just sours so much of the movie. Like, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth that no amount of Gatorade, booze, coffee, or candy could fully expose for my body, as if I had not done enough of that this week. If you've followed me at Facebook or talked to me, I was tremendously sick, and it wasn't because of watching this movie, but let's just say the Hulk showed up in my house in more ways than one. All in all, it's an ambitious failure, and I have to call it a failure because I don't think it works as a singular film. But I also would have loved to have seen this if Ang Lee was attached from the start. Would this have felt as Frankensteined and mishmashed and at war with itself? Probably not. But I also don't know if Universal, if Ang Lee showed up in 1998 or whatever and pitched this movie, these themes, this level of trauma at the core of the Hulk, I don't think they would have given him the job. I firmly believe that would not have been the case. And certainly in comparison to other superhero films, putting this right after X2, I think hurt it a lot in my estimation and in the population for that matter. But I can't call it terrible. There are aspects that are horrendous, the dogs and the big monster fight at the end, which reminded me of Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, which is not something you want to be compared to. But I wish we had more movies in the genre that took chances like this. I think because of fan expectations and the internet, I don't think you're going to see that because of the risk of backlash. But I think we're due for something of this scale again. And I can't remember the last one we had that really felt bold. I guess you could say Man of Steel. But we talked about the aftermath of that in great detail. Go back to those shows. They're great. And I kind of feel the same way about this movie that I felt about Man of Steel. And I'm probably going to give it the same score. I think I'm going to give it a 5. So I'm as close in the middle of the two of you as possible. So, like I said, I can't call it the worst thing ever. I admire its purity, to quote Alien. But at the same time, I also don't think it's the purest thing because the stitches are on full display. And it's because of this movie's reputation that a sequel never got made. Avi Arad wanted a sequel. They were going to do the Grey Hulk. They were going to use Leader and Abomination. But the project was shelved because Universal didn't meet the deadline to keep the rights.
Yeah.
And history was changed forever. But it's history we'll talk about once we get into the MCU proper, because this is going to be the end of our Hulk retrospective until we get to the Marvel Cinematic Universe proper, because that film is its own thing. But ironically, you could look at it as a sequel to this if you really wanted to.
Only the continuity that has to do with the jungle, that's it.
Yeah, but I don't think they're the same. Everyone's recast and all that, but if you want to look at it from that lens, you can squint really closely and do that.
Yeah.
I don't think it fully would have worked. Not just because they recast, but you know, that's the legacy of this movie. It soured a lot of people on the Hulk and on superhero films for a while. Unless you were X-Men and Spider-Man at Marvel, you almost weren't doing well. It was like Daredevil, this, The Punisher, Man-Thing. Unless you were one of the golden children, you weren't taken seriously. That'll put the Hulk to rest. We'll repress our anger. Although Adams might be coming out when you announce what our next retrospective is. So I'll turn it over to you. Although it's technically much like Marvel, it's something worth... It's an ongoing retrospective, but it's about as large in scope. So what's next in the world of percolated media?
Oh, boy. Well, before I get to the next series of shows, I do want to say in between retrospectives, we are going to post our Black Phone 2 review 6-7 months later. Yes, it's taken a while. We explained on that show why it's taken that long. So you'll get that show. And then... year later, well, actually a set of months later, because we did The Running Man last year, we're going back to Stephen King. And it's going to be the most interesting set of King that we've done. We're going to start with the novel that came out in publishing order, which is The Gunslinger, a.k.a. The Dark Tower. Oh my God. And all the volumes and things that has to do with that series along with that movie. It's an hour and a half movie, and good Lord, there's so much to discuss with that film. But after we get through that, we are going to go to different seasons. Now, this is a set of shows I've been looking forward to forever because it has some of the most well-received films of Stephen King's adaptations. It has Apt Pupil, which is Bryan Singer's edition. It has The Shawshank Redemption, Frank Darabont, and it has Stand By Me, the late Rob Reiner's coming-of-age movie. And you know what? I've told these guys in private, I'm going to tell it right now, I don't know if I'll be able to get through those shows without crying. However, I will say, I think there's going to be a battle of contention right off the bat, because I am not as high on Shawshank as a lot of people are. And I'll give those reasons why when we get to that show. And in the order that we're going to do, we're going to do Shawshank, and then Apt Pupil, and then Stand By Me, because guess what? That's how they appear in the book. And then we're going to conclude that set of King with a review of Christine. And do I have a lot of things to say about that? Not to mention, I understand that in actuality, Creepshow came out in 82. And me and Matt did have a discussion about that. And we decided as an executive decision that we're going to go ahead and save those shows since it's four more shows. No, it's four because we have Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, along with the three Creepshow films. So, so we're going to save those for another time. But next, we're going to have Dark Tower. After that, we're going to have different seasons. And we're going to conclude with Christine.
And I'm sure Adam is just overjoyed to be discussing Stephen King, especially once that he is the guy who has not seen Shawshank or Stand By Me.
You saw Shawshank, Adam, right? I thought you said you saw Shawshank, or did you?
So it's amazing that people want to know how this is going to go for Bunch. I saw Apt Pupil in theaters. I just saw Shawshank about a year ago at home for the first time, and I've never seen Stand By Me.
You are a nudnik. You know that?
God, I am an enigma. I am an enigma wrapped in a cannoli. Fuck, what can I say?
I cannot believe you've never seen Stand By Me. I can't wait to get to that show. Oh my God. That show.
Blame the Goonies. That's why. Fuck the Goonies.
Well, I think in a lot of ways you can blame Stand By Me for Wonder Years, but we'll talk about that. But those shows might go 2+ hours each. I am so excited to talk about those films because there's a lot to dive into with all of those. And that is, in a lot of people's minds, the best volume of short stories or novellas, as they're called, that King's ever written. So I can't wait to get to those.
Well, I have certain ones that I like more than others in that slate, but plenty to talk about. So until next time, when we review The Dark Tower 2017, we're buried out here in the middle of nowhere. How long are you going to keep him podcasting? For the rest of his natural life, if I have to. Which is how Adam feels discussing Stephen King. Thank you, everyone.
That I'm dead. But they also think that this creature inside of me is a murderer, and they may someday be right. It's not human. Maybe it's what we were before we became human. Maybe it's the worst in us.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
You really believe that I am separate from you?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
My mother always used to tell me getting angry doesn't help.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Mission Impossible film series, the Jaws franchise, the Lethal Weapon films, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, Avatar, and so much more.
I feel somehow we're alike.
I guess we could all learn something from the big goof.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I made a stink bomb once. Cleared out the whole school. What a wonderful fiasco. The whole school. My friends kept my secret, but forevermore they called me Stinky. Stinky!
Scheduling done by Matt.
Look at him. He lives for every second. To hell with tomorrow. Not a worry in the world. The worry he leaves to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What is it that you pound on my door with such insolence?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Security ought to be beefed up a lot more. In a place like this, you can't be too careful.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
you ready?
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Where will you go?
The city.
That's not a good place. People get lost in that city.
You have to stop someplace.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production, copyright 2026, and any and all sound clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
You take my secret with you.
And I leave mine with you. I have a brother in the world now.
Yes, you do.
My hand is in front of
me. I know.
You can leave us now.
Mr. Gaudreau, are you ready, sir?
All right, I'm ready.
All right.
Yeah, I'm ready. I can't believe we have not talked about this movie in the 10 years we've been.
Oh my god.
Fucking reviewing movies.
Oh, I feel like the Hulk. I'm about ready to burst because I've been wanting to talk about this as well. We are going all in right. 3, 2, and 1.
Hulk. Because we have to remember also, comic book movies were not yet taken seriously because we were not too far. In fact, we were months removed from Batman and Robin, almost nuking the entire genre.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are you going to get to one of the stars of Batman Forever being in one of these scripts?
Eventually.
Okay. That was all right. We're not
something
there
that was thrown out. But Okay. Especially with Marvel, when you look at Stephen Norrington directed Blade, who had only done like one or two movies before that.
Yeah, he did.
Neither of which big.
Yeah, he did a Deathgasm or some weird
Death Machine.
Death Machine.
Brad Dourif, I think, is in it.
I remember that. We'll talk about this when we get to Blade, but I remember that. Adam, remember when I worked at Hollywood Video and I would see that fucking video box all the time? It was like a Freddy Krueger ripoff of the steel claw coming out of and yeah, that was the draw to that. Yeah, they were kind of plucking directors like this left and right.
Which is also more impressive because Spider-Man kind of set the formula for superhero films for a long time. Especially the first one for characters like Daredevil, Hulk, but Daredevil, the Punisher.
Matt, before you chime in, I want to talk to Adam for a second because you're not going to have an opinion on this. We have themes being done by Danny Elfman here. And
oh, I was going to comment. I thought we were talking about the color grading.
Oh, okay.
You too.
All right, go ahead.
I was like, I see where this is going.
Okay, I'll save it. No, Danny Elfman. Now, they had hired Ang Lee's... And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake to not have David Banner be the one who causes the accident that turns Bruce Banner into the Hulk.
He should be dead if he's that injured for him to be walking around considering what the Hulk does to him.
Yeah. And we're going to see it with Tim Roth in when we get to that movie too. It's just like,
well, that one, at least you could say he had the super soldier serum
eventually, but I don't know.
No, he has it from the beginning.
Basically from the beginning? I haven't seen that movie in way too long. I don't remember.
Yeah, outside of the, the first chase.
Yeah.
When they
You should have been dead when you got thrown against that tree. Oh, we'll talk about it.
No, but he had the super soldier. He had the super soldier serum at that point.
Did he? Oh my
god. We'll get there.
Yes,
we'll get there.
Too long.
Yeah, we'll get there in a couple years. But he takes out the dogs. We only see him do this like twice. It's only here to set up the climax. Excuse me.
Bless you.
One sec. There we go. And it's only here to...
Well, I don't think they wanted to show any more of the destruction than they needed to because of the war that was going on. That's my belief.
Mm. Would you say it was ultimate destruction? I will bow my head in shame, but also I will keep my head up high.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's a video game reference for those of you who don't get that. There was a video game. It was better than the actual tie-in game for this.
Which I never played, believe it or not.
Which wasn't bad. Wasn't horrible.
That's the stealth missions can go to fucking hell, though. But I can say that about, like I said on last week, every stealth
super say that mission. For every game that's not Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Hulk Goat Leap.
Nobody on the streets of San Francisco, which never exists. So they did some weird changes for reasons that are inexplicable to me.
Well, I don't think they wanted
to
show...
Would you say it was...
I was just going to say...
Would you say...
I was just going to say, I don't think